From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made every day as the temperature continues to drop and the days become darker earlier. For many people, gathering outdoors where the virus is less of a risk has ended, so the ways we socialized has once again changed. We're back inside our bubbles, many of us anyway. Bubble is another one of those pandemic-related words that you probably hear a lot these days. The idea is that you can gather indoors with people who don't live with you, without wearing masks and without being physically distant, as long as those groups are small and exclusive. Earlier this year, researchers said that limiting social interactions and sticking with the same group of people could help mitigate the spread of the virus. But as the Atlantic Monthly recently reported, bubbles or pods, as they're also called, mean different things to different people. Sometimes they're too big. Sometimes they're too porous, The Atlantic reports. Sometimes the rules aren't clear, rendering the approach not so effective. In the Atlantic piece, Rachel Gutman writes, quote, "If we do not reach a consensus on best bubbling practices soon, we risk blasting a hole in one layer of our armor and opening ourselves up as a nation to even more unnecessary sickness and death," end quote. She says we need pods now more than ever, but due to the rise in COVID cases, those pods can be more dangerous than ever if we're not following the rules. So, a question, are you part of a pod? What does it look like? What rules do you follow? And is podding too unrealistic for some people, some groups of people, particularly those who live in poverty or who are housing insecure? This hour, we explore the issue with our guests, who will also help answer your questions about pods and bubbles. I'd like to welcome my guest. Dr. Deborah Pierce is a clinical associate professor of family medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Pierce, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
Dr. Paul Grayman is a hospital epidemiologist in the Infectious Diseases Division at URMC. Dr. Grayman, welcome back to you.
Thanks. Happy to be with you.
Andy Carey is the co-founder of MC Collaborative and co-chair of REACH Advocacy. That stands for Rochester Emergency Action Committee for the Homeless. Andy, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Kelly Govan is a Pittsburgh resident and associate professor of biology at FLCC. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So in a moment, we'll hear Kelly's story and her experience with bubbles or not bubbles. We'll let her share that. But first, I'd like to discuss the idea of pods in general with Dr. Pierce and Dr. Grayman. And Dr. Grayman, I'd like to start with you. Can you give us a sense for how you feel about the idea of pods and bubbles?
Sure. I think we get into a problem when we try to put numbers on these things, like, you know, 10 people is safe or 5 is safe or 15 or whatever it is, because there are no magic numbers. And I think what people have to understand when it comes to COVID, the more people you have contact with, the higher the risk. The higher the risk that you're going to contract COVID, the higher the risk that you're going to spread it to others, and most seriously, the risk that any of us would inadvertently spread it to somebody who is vulnerable to having more severe COVID disease, that is, older people and people with underlying conditions. So, you know, putting a magic number on it is a problem. And I think the concept really needs to be that all of us should attempt to have contact with as few a number of people as possible. Preferably, that would be our immediate household, the people that we live with all the time and have contact with on a daily basis, usually our family. As soon as you get outside that number of people, that group of people, the risk increases. And it doesn't matter how many that is. It could be a relatively small number, and the risk increases as the number goes up. And the concern when you're in a pod or a bubble, say it's you and a number of friends or other family members who don't live with you, each of those people in turn has contact with other people in their lives. So the numbers begin to multiply when you consider how many people are really having contact with one another. It's not just those in your pod or bubble, but all the people that they have contact with, and subsequently, you know, that group of people will have contact with even larger numbers. And I think that's what the Atlantic article talks about. So I think understanding the concept is what's important, is that the fewest number of people is the safest. As hard as that is, that should be what we strive for. It's not always going to be possible for many people, depending on their circumstances, but that's the goal.
And I think the possibility of keeping that group small isn't something that's realistic for some people, as we'll talk about with Andy soon, Dr. Grayman. One more question for you about this. Dr. Mendoza, when he was on this program before Thanksgiving, he said, quote, "The pod is a theoretical concept because everyone in the pod has a different pod that they interact with," end quote. And he says, "In practice, it doesn't totally work in today's day and age." And it sounds, Dr. Grayman, that you agree with that. Do you think that pods give us a false sense of security, or do you think there's some value in the concept?
Well, I think both. It does give a false sense of security, so that, you know, if you identify 6 or 8 or 10 people that are in your pod, that somehow, if those are the only people you see, that somehow it's safe, because all of them may see 8 or 10 people in turn, and the risk increases. So I think it does give a false sense of security. On the other hand, the concept still applies, that if you create a bubble or a pod with a limited number of people, it's still safer than just being with an indefinite, undefined group of people. The more contained your pod or bubble is, the safer you are, but it's not complete safety. And I think people have to understand that it's not giving you like a free pass of safety because you're limiting the number of people you're with. We very frequently now are seeing people who are infected because they didn't realize that those in their pod may have become infected from people that they have seen in their other pods in other parts of their life. So it's like an octopus with tentacles that spread much further than the individual pod that you're in.
Dr. Pierce, do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, nobody wants to think that their friends who they trust are going to do something that may harm them. So we all assume that, you know, I'm super careful. I don't go anywhere without my mask on. I don't really interact with anybody except remotely, except for work. And I would like to assume that anybody who I might choose to get away to have contact with would be equally careful. But we don't all have the same agreement about how careful each of us is going to be. I would like to assume that my friends are as meticulous as I am. But that can be a really hard conversation to have. And I think, you know, with the winter months coming up, with the holidays coming up, this is a really good time for people to talk, not about what my pod is, what behavior I expect from people, and how I can do what I need to do to get through this time in a safe fashion.
I know that's something that you and I talked about briefly off air, how you're having conversations with your patients about safety. And you said that has changed over the course of the pandemic. Can you walk me through how it began and what changed over the course of these months?
So normally coming up on a holiday or something, you know, there's a little bit of, hey, what are you doing? Do you have plans? And what I realized is I don't want to be in a situation where somebody offers a plan, which I then criticize. I'd rather say, let's make a plan. Let's talk about what's important. You know, let's talk about what connections you need to make and how you can do them in a distant, outdoor, remote, masked kind of a way.
What are some of the reactions you're getting from patients who may not necessarily understand the risk that they may put themselves in certain situations, or maybe even some of the science?
It's been variable. And I think, like anything else, talking about health risks, talking about texting when driving, talking about being distracted, avoiding smoking, all of those things, they may not make a change in their behavior right now, but maybe they'll think about it more and down the line be more cautious.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with Dr. Grayman about putting a number on a pod or a bubble as sort of an arbitrary thing?
You really can't, because it has to be people who really have the same understanding and the same degree of compulsiveness at all times. And even if there's 50 people who have the same degree of compulsiveness, if even one of them has a momentary slip, there's 50 people who you may infect who may then carry it on to, you know, further and further. So the fewer the better, preferably household only, when possible.
Well, when we talk to Kelly Govan in just a moment, I think both of the medical experts on today's panel will be pleased to hear how her family is approaching pods and bubbles, or the concept in general, based on what they've just said. But there are a few emails that came in about just concerns that listeners have regarding family situations. And I'd like to read one of them for the doctors now before we talk to Kelly. This email comes from Philip, and he says, "This is a timely conversation. My family is feeling tension over the idea of pods, specifically Christmas pods. My mother is in her late 70s. Her health has not been great. She has three adult sons, all in different states, including me. One of my brothers is adamant that he is not coming home for Christmas. I agree with him. I would never forgive myself if I brought the virus to my mother. But our other brother is going home, and he's giving us all kinds of grief. He's telling us that we can safely create a temporary family pod with her during Christmas week. He says there are safe ways to do it. I certainly understand that my mother's health matters more, and she wants to see her kids and grandkids. I want to see her, too. Typically, we all come in for about a week around Christmas. She's not telling us directly that she thinks we should come. She's leaving it up to us. My brother is the one who is on our case. He says he'll get tested right before he goes to be with her, and that he'll only go out to a few stores during the week. My mother is only telling us that it's very hard not seeing her kids and grandkids, and she hasn't seen us since last Christmas, and she can't wait to see us again. Sorry for such a long note. We are just struggling. I know she wants us to come. I don't want to harm her mental health, but I feel like we are so close to vaccines, and I think pods are leaky to begin with. The idea of trying to create a new secure pod during Christmas week with the most vulnerable person in my life worries me." And again, that's from Philip. Dr. Grayman, what would you say to Philip?
Well, I share the concern and the frustration. I mean, this is extraordinarily difficult for all of us. But I think she's right. You know, this is one Christmas. There'll be many more Christmases and many other holidays where we can decide that sometime in March or April we're going to have a delayed Christmas and call it Christmas in April. What we most want is people to stay healthy and alive. And one Christmas that causes the death of people in our community that would not otherwise have happened is just something that none of us want to see. So I think the best strategy is to avoid family gatherings if at all possible. And I think that's the safest way to go, especially when there's vulnerable people involved. And, you know, the issue of getting tested, I think testing helps if people are going to come and gather. But it is, again, it is not a free pass. The test is only as good as the day that it was done on. So, for example, if her brother who lives somewhere else in the country got exposed to somebody with COVID on a Monday and gets tested on Wednesday, and then a test is negative and comes to Rochester on Thursday, well, you know what? That brother could still come down with COVID on Saturday or Sunday or Monday or Tuesday, even though they had a negative test before they traveled here. So a negative test, while it's somewhat helpful and reassuring, it falls far short of being totally safe. And I don't think people should view it as being, if you will, a free pass to safety. So I think we just have to be really cautious about gatherings that we could otherwise prevent.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pierce, what would you tell Philip?
It's the same thing. I feel this anguish. My mother is of a certain age, and I was on call last Christmas, so I was really hoping to be able to visit this year, and there's just no way it's safe. You know, not if even if I got tested, I don't have time to test and then isolate there for 10 days to keep her safe. And so we're working on ways to do this remotely with a plan that sometime in the spring we'll get together. We're calling our holiday vaccinalia because it's our celebration of vaccination.
I like that.
That's good.
Well, I know that Kelly has approached at least one holiday a little differently this year than she probably had planned in January. And Kelly Govan, again, is a Pittsburgh resident who agreed to share her thought process about bubbling or not bubbling on this program. We asked our listeners how they felt about it. We got a range of responses, and I'll read those in a few moments. But Kelly, let's start with Thanksgiving. Your Thanksgiving looked a little different than the traditional gathering your family had been used to, correct?
Sure. Yeah, we've made a decision for my family to not form a bubble or a pod. And we went round and round about Thanksgiving, and we had those beautiful warm days just before. And my mother called us all on a Thursday and said, why don't you all come over this weekend? It's warm out. We'll sit in the garage. We'll put tables up for each family 6 feet apart. Everybody can bring a dish. Everybody will wear masks except when they're eating, and we can celebrate early. So it's sort of the other side of, instead of delaying it, we rushed it early to get it in the good weather.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned
and we sat in the garage with everyone, and it was nice. We're lucky that we're all local, right? We're not in the situation that Philip's in, where everybody has to travel. My brother lives in town. My parents live in town. My aunt and uncle are just down the road. My cousin just lives a couple towns over, so we're very close.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate you saying that, you know, you're lucky or you're fortunate in that regard, because different families have different situations, different limitations. And, you know, this is a difficult conversation for so many families to have, especially if different people within those family groups disagree about the approach. It sounds like all of you were on the same page with that.
Yeah, we're fortunate that way, too. I mean, what it comes down to is both of my parents, along with being in an age group of high risk, are high risk for other reasons. My dad is a paraplegic and has been confined to a wheelchair for more than 50 years, which is amazing in and of itself. But as you can imagine, with a spinal cord injury, a respiratory illness would be very fatal, and especially a respiratory illness like this. So we're all really careful because we love him a lot. And it's really an act of love that we're staying away from each other.
So you're not in a bubble. How does the you and your, I assume you, your kids, you're sticking with your own household. And
So it's a little complicated for us because I'm divorced. So I share custody of three kids. So when you start to figure in sharing custody and two sets of jobs and two schools for three kids, and I work two jobs, and my ex-husband and his partner have jobs, and that increases the number of contacts that we have. And we've made some decisions about what acceptable risk is for all of us and our kids, and not exposing additional people to that risk, particularly the people in our lives that are most at risk.
So I don't want to use the word bubble because I know you don't call it a bubble.
Right. It really isn't fair to call it a bubble. Although we've made ways to make sure that the other piece of this is we're very, very close with my parents. My mother has watched the kids since they were born. She's always gotten the kids either on the bus or off the bus a couple days a week for, you know, forever. They've made gingerbread houses together. They decorate Christmas cookies together every year. She takes them on hayrides. I mean, it's an incredibly close grandparent relationship. And this has been unspeakably hard for them all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she hasn't hugged a grandkid since March.
Yeah.
She hasn't been within 10 feet of a grandkid since March. And we live 2 miles from them. So we're trying to find ways to keep that connection alive, but separate.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways you've done that? I know you said you've become very creative.
So for the first time we really got together was the twins' birthday in June, and we set up tables in my parents' front yard and had lunch together that way and had cupcakes that we were able to share, but not, you know, share in order to have birthday cake. And when we were really, really locked down, we played bingo and Yahtzee over Zoom. My mom made up little sheets so that the kids could play Yahtzee and learn together, and delivered a kit so that they could learn and put up a Zoom, and they would play during their lunch breaks in remote class. And bingo was great because we could take turns calling numbers and picking different kinds of games for bingo. And you can do that easily with very little input of stuff. We've made use of some computer games that way, too. We've been talking about some gingerbread house decorating over Zoom as well, and being able to, you know, sit in the car and yell back and forth in the garage from each other. And we've been lucky that when we moved here, when I was in third grade in the 80s, my parents bought a house that had a pool. So my parents would sit on the deck overlooking the pool, or the window overlooking it, and I would have the kids at the pool, and they would yell back and forth. It was like, you know, an old sitcom where you're yelling at a window across from each other. So at least we've been able to see each other and share our lives a little bit.
How old are your kids, Kelly?
I have 15-year-old twins and a 10-year-old.
How are they handling everything? I know it's hard on your parents not seeing their grandkids. How are the kids handling the restrictions, the rules, the sacrifices?
So I'm really fortunate. I have just really remarkable children. They have been amazing. It's hard not to see their friends, but they're also finding ways to adapt to hang out with their friends. There's collaborative video games that they're all making use of. Making use of outdoor heaters to be able to spend some time outside with each other, and biking to school so that they can spend a little bit of time together, or biking around neighborhoods. And they understand the restrictions, and they're, even though it's hard, they've really adapted well.
That's great. I think different kids are handling this in different ways, but overall the feedback that we've been hearing is kids are resilient, they adapt so well, and they're making it work. We can take some lessons from kids, I think, as adults, especially when it comes to some of the rules, like masking and what they're doing in school. Kelly,
absolutely. I'm amazed at how often my 10-year-old forgets to take off her mask.
I know that, you know, it sounds like everyone in your family is on the same page. They're handling it as best they can. And I'm thinking about the vaccine. Does the vaccine news give you any hope that the limits you've placed on the situation won't be necessary too much longer? And also, I'd like to know if, say, we heard that the vaccine, this is a hypothetical, this is not true, but if it weren't coming for another year or more, do you think you would change the way that you were adapting to the pandemic?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't think it would change how we've been dealing with seeing my parents. I think it's possible that my brother and I would have some conversations about changing our interactions in terms of the safety of our own pods. I'm not sure about that. You know, I think that we would think about how we can make outdoor gatherings more comfortable, even in the cold weather. I can't imagine putting my kids at any risk, even if it's a minimal risk, to change indoor gatherings or bubbles or pods that way. They're taking on a little bit of risk in their own sports and other activities, but I can't imagine that I would be comfortable with other acceptable risks in terms of their health.
Dr. Pierce, I know different families are mitigating risks in various ways. How do you feel about Kelly's decisions and some of the choices that seem to work for her family?
I think she's doing a perfect job, you know, trying to be outdoors as much as possible, masking as much as possible, masking always. And I agree. Kids get used to it. It becomes their normal. And it's less of a loss if it is normal at a younger age, I think.
I think that's true. And thank you, Dr. Pierce.
Listeners, that's a perfect opportunity to remind you that you can ask the experts your questions. The number here is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. 563-9994. You can email your question to connections@wxxi.org, and you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. I do see the phone starting to ring. We'll take one listener question, and then I want to make sure we talk to Andy Carey from the MC Collaborative and Reach Advocacy about some of the important work his groups are doing to help people who are living in poverty, who are homeless, do the best they can to mitigate risk. So, but first up on the phone is Gordon in Geneseo. Go ahead, Gordon.
Thank you. I was just wondering, a friend of mine, it's a family with a mother and two children. One of the children has COVID, and she told me that they are, you know, they're all around the house together wearing masks. And I was just wondering if that was safer, if the one child that does have COVID should be separated from everybody else.
Okay, thanks, Gordon. Dr. Grayman, you want to take that one?
Sure. If you look at kind of the formal recommendations from federal government and state and so forth, is that anybody within the household with COVID should be isolated from the rest of the household to the extent that it's possible. So ideally, that person would be in their own room and not interacting with others outside the room. They should have food brought to them and so forth, limiting contact as much as possible. And if there does need to be contact because of just the circumstances in the house and who has single rooms, private, you know, bedrooms and so forth, that when there is interaction, that people be masked, everyone be masked during an interaction, the person who has COVID and the others. But that, you know, that's a pretty tall order for a lot of families and a lot of households. So I think people need to do the best that they can, try to stay apart, but when they are together, to limit that time and to wear masks, and to particularly try to limit time when people are eating, when they can't have masks on, because it's during those times that the risk is probably highest, when people are close together and not wearing masks because they're eating.
Gordon, does that answer your question?
Yes, I think it does. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. Up next, this is from Bob, who emails us. He says, one of my closest friends was homeless for several years when I was in college. He lived on my couch. It took years for him to become independent, and now he's doing great. But I'm thinking of people like him who are working hard but don't have a home of their own. Can we really lecture them about pods or bubbles or who they're exposed to? Again, that's from Bob, and that is a question that I think Andy Carey can help us answer. He is the co-founder of MC Collaborative and co-chair of Reach Advocacy, Rochester Emergency Action Committee for the Homeless. Andy, thanks again for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, of course. And yeah, that is a great question from Bob, and I think that's something we all think about. I know when COVID, when we were first aware of COVID coming into the area in the beginning of March, we were obviously very concerned because a lot of the folks we serve in shelter have underlying health conditions, significant mental health or addiction issues that might make precautions more difficult. So we were very nervous. Gratefully, the county emergency housing team was able to secure hotel rooms for us by the end of the month, and House of Mercy and Open Door Mission and Reach moved a lot of people in there, kind of an attempt at our own very porous pod, trying to get everyone separated and working with folks. The reality is when you're in a vulnerable position, a lot of services are communal. So, you know, a typical person might have breakfast at Asbury, lunch at St. Peter's, dinner at Blessed Sacrament, and then go to a shelter. In all of those spots, there's dozens of people. So you may run into hundreds of people in a day. So podding is very difficult. We were grateful to get the hotel rooms and try and bring all the services and food and everything in so that people could go out as little as possible. You know, obviously we don't control people and what they do, but at least we could kind of control our space. We did a lot of disinfecting, hand washing, mask wearing, social distancing, less volunteers. I'm just basically motivating people to remember to socially distance And so far, it's worked out well, I think much better than I had anticipated. We're lucky we haven't had any, at least none known positive COVID cases amongst the folks. And we've also had a chance to work with people on getting into housing, which has been nice because that's definitely the safest way to weather a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So,
how many people are able to be in the hotel right now, Andy?
So originally, when we first heard everything, we had about 120 rooms. We're down to a much smaller number now, but as winter comes back, you know, obviously we have a really good shelter capacity work group and a task force trying to figure out the best way to do this. And we may have to increase the hotel rooms again, or maybe our shelter system will be able to handle it. We kind of work on it as a week-to-week basis. So, but I think we've had over 200 people through the hotels, and a lot of people have been housed and moved on to safer situations, so that's been great.
Going back to Bob's question, do you think that the public conversation that the nation is having right now about limits and pods and bubbles are too exclusive or even unfair for some of the people you're talking about, you're working with?
Yeah, I think it obviously, it's a bit unfair, especially if you're, just trying to get your basic needs met. You have to be out in the community. So that makes it hard. But I also think it's stimulated a real conversation about how are we going to work on these health inequities and, you know, maybe our shelter systems and our systems for helping people meet their basic needs aren't the best, and we need to redevelop them. So it's exciting in that sense as well. So I'm hoping something positive comes out of all of this.
Well, that brings me to a question. Let's say you were in an outdoor space wearing a mask with some local leaders, with national leaders, experts on the legislative side, on the medical field. What is one or two things that you really think your organizations need to help mitigate some of these risks and to help set them on a path to long-term success? If you were to create some kind of wish list, what would it include?
Yeah, I think when I think of like kind of the hierarchy of needs, it really falls back on housing. And I'm a social worker and I see all the needs as important, but having a lot more housing, better housing, different styles of housing. You know, an apartment by yourself isn't for everybody. Communal living is fine as long as we can space people out as needed. So I really think that would be my first push, is fixing the housing stock of the United States, maybe even getting back into building public housing, which we haven't done in a long time. But just really focusing in on that. And I think this pandemic really shines a light on that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pierce, this is an issue that you and I also talked about off air, the disparities with the virus, specifically the virus affecting African Americans more than other ethnicities. They're dying at higher rates, people in poverty being disproportionately affected. How do you feel about some of the things Andy's describing?
I agree. I mean, I think it's not fair to basically shame people for having a poor and difficult economic situation. The way I see it is more those of us who have the privilege of being able to isolate and distance as much as possible should, because if we can bring the number of cases in the community down, it not only helps us, but it helps those who are more vulnerable be at lower risk. If there are fewer people out there with COVID, there's less of a chance of somebody who can't isolate being exposed to it.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from Stephanie on Twitter, more a comment, I should say. She says, unfortunately, I think most people's bubbles have burst, but they don't realize it. There are exceptions, but I find many who talk about having a bubble are including kids on sports teams, people eating in restaurants. We must avoid creating a false sense of safety. So thinking about that, for people who are able to limit their bubbles and do feel like those bubbles have become too big, Dr. Grayman, I'll start with you. What do you think the best way to communicate that fear to the pod is? Knowing some people may be upset or offended that we're reducing the size of the bubble, how can they do that?
Well, you know, we're all in this together, and people have to do everything they can. And you know, when it comes to making sacrifices, you know, it depends what your yardstick is. People have made sacrifices by giving their lives for our country and wars in other parts of the world. And in contrast to those sacrifices, canceling a family gathering or a holiday or wearing masks when you might feel you really don't want to. And those are sacrifices that I think many of us can make. Some can't for the reasons we've talked about, because of their socioeconomic status, you know, their housing status and so forth. But for those who can, I mean, these are sacrifices that people need to put into perspective and to make those sacrifices when they can. And another way to look at this is that it goes beyond, you know, our individual pods and who might get sick and within our pod or our bubble that we never intended, and it's a big surprise when it happens. But if you think of every, looking at us in the aggregate, so that say every 100 households or every 100 pods turns out to have a couple of people get sick because their pod was not as tight as it could be. Well, a couple of people sick for every 100 households or pods or bubbles in Rochester would mean thousands of additional people potentially getting sick, and many of those people ending up in the hospital and some dying. So those little decisions we make within our own families or pods and collectively can have a huge impact on what happens in our healthcare system, where we run out of beds, we run out of people to take care of those patients, and we have more people die than we ever want to see. So the little decisions we make in our own lives, in our own bubbles, altogether, collectively, can have a huge impact on what happens in our community and our hospitals.
You just touched on an issue that was the subject of a piece by Yasha Monk in the Atlantic on November 24th, and it was called "Your Individually Rational Choice is Collectively Disastrous." And he describes exactly what you just discussed, Dr. Grayman. And here's a quote. He says, "Let's assume, for example, that going to a large indoor gathering gives you a 1 in 20 chance of contracting COVID-19, a significant risk. Most likely, you'll get away with it the first time. Then you'll infer that taking part in such a gathering is pretty safe, and you'll do it again. Eventually, you are highly likely to fall sick." So listeners, if you have access, The Atlantic is making all of its pieces on COVID free. So if you can access the internet, check out that piece from Yasha Monk. It's very, very, it helps you think in different ways. And I think he describes some of the fears that we all have and helps us understand the way that we think. Dr. Grayman, what do you think about that, individual choices and collective actions? Or Dr. Pierce, I'm sorry.
Right, sure.
I agree. I mean, think of all the times we do something stupid that we know we probably shouldn't. For instance, texting when driving. How many times does somebody say, "Oh, that's a really important message. Let me just answer it really quickly." You know it's not a good idea, but maybe somebody will do it. And the first time, it's no big deal. But then eventually they respond to a text. They take too long, and there's a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Only in this case, instead of one person getting into an accident, maybe the car they're driving plows off the street and hits a bunch of unrelated pedestrians. And so it's the same thing. It may seem tempting to do it once, but that doesn't mean it's okay ever.
Well, we're down to our last few minutes, and I apologize to the listeners who wrote in or are waiting on the phone. We just are flooded with phone calls and questions, which is really great. And I know I'll say to some of you who have questions about the business community, we are having a conversation tomorrow at noon about some of those issues. So tune in then and call back if you'd like. And if you have questions about vaccines, I want to remind you we're having a live televised forum on Thursday, December 17th. It's at 8 p.m. And you can ask local experts questions about vaccines. They are leading the effort nationally to get those vaccines developed and make sure they're safe and help distribute them. So again, that's Thursday the 17th at 8 p.m. If you have questions, you can leave a voicemail at 258-0258. 258-0258, or you can email your question to forum@wxxi.org. So in our last few minutes, I'd like to give each of our guests a final statement of sorts, and I'll start with you, Kelly. you have made some decisions that work well with your family. How are you feeling? Hopeful? Are you feeling stressed? What are you feeling when you look at the next several months?
I guess I have mixed feelings. I'm feeling more hopeful than I had before. I think the vaccine news is very encouraging. My profession is as a biology professor, so I'm following that news very, very closely. And I think it is really encouraging. I am encouraged by the way that my children and their friends are handling this and by the response of people in the community and in the people that I talk to and the things that I've heard from Dr. Pierce and Dr. Grayman. And if you don't mind, just quickly, Andy, is there anything that individual members of the community could do to help your organization as we're coming into the cold? Are there things that you need or a place that we could go to help you? That's one of the things that I have found with my own kids when they feel anxious, that if we can channel that anxiety to help other people, things go so much better in our own home.
I love that. Thank you, Kelly.
Sure.
Yeah, that is wonderful. And I agree, you know, kind of help others and it helps ourselves as well. And that's what it feels like I've enjoyed about this whole conversation, especially the doctors, is how interdependent we all really are. And sometimes it takes a pandemic to point that out. I'm not big into shamelessly plugging our own stuff, but if you could, the Reach Advocacy website does a good job of pointing us in different directions on how we can help people. Because sometimes, you know, we're starting to do a walking social work team, and just handing out gloves and hand warmers and water seems more important than anything right now. So that website will be able to guide you in some things you could do that will directly impact people.
And we'll post a link.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. We'll post a link to that website on our podcast page for this discussion. And we're down to our last 30 seconds, Dr. Pierce and Dr. Grayman. Your final words for the listeners. We'll start with you, Dr. Pierce.
I know this is really a tough time, but hang in there. We'll get through it. The end is in sight.
Thank you. And Dr. Grayman.
Yeah, I think we have to be hopeful about this. We are going to get through this. Doing the right thing for all of us is really an act of love, and that's the way we need to look at it. I have a poster that I got last spring, which is mounted in the entry to my house, which says, "Stay home. It's never been that easy to save lives." It turns out it's not so easy to stay home, but in fact, we can save lives by trying to do the right thing.
Thank you, Dr. Grayman, and thank you to Dr. Deborah Pierce, Andy Carey, and Kelly Govan, and all of the important questions and comments we had. Stay with us, listeners. We have more Connections next.